independent contributors we have. Each person owns one resource, and that's themselves, and they make the decision about what they want to work on. And that tends to work out quite well. If no party out there is prepared to pony up the programmer hours for a particular feature, then it's a fair bet that we really didn't want that feature anyway. And tell us about the features they intend to work on over the next year, and we'll sit there and nod politely. Although we tend to wait and see what the patch looks like before we make any sort of commitment. But it's not a process such as you see in a corporate environment, where the leaders will get together and decide on a feature set and then allocate programmers to it in a sort of outward and downward flowing direction. It's rather interesting, but it does work. As I say, I don't have any staff, but occasionally I will reach out and ask a particular developer to do a particular piece of work, and they always do so because I know what to ask them to do. It's usually quite a small job that I'll ask people to do, and I view it more as a request, can you please do me a favour, rather than an actual assignment or work for someone to do. Just to say that his most important function is in rejecting patches rather than accepting them. Presumably that's under the assumption that increases the quality of the kernel, because only the best stuff gets in. I diametrically disagree with him on that front. I think that even if somebody sends you a word wrap, you said that, Mum. The fact is, that person had a reason for writing that piece of crap. It's almost always the case that the patch does address some bug or some missing feature or some shortcoming in the kernel. So even the kernel, which ends up losing out, because that requirement which made that person do the work, it hasn't gone away. And we're going to hit the problem later on. Somebody else is going to hit the bug or find that they're missing the feature or whatever. So I think the maintainer's function should be to work with the originator of that patch, understand the bug or the requirement which led him to do that work, and generally work with that person and other people rather than taking some pride in rejecting them. So there. I don't silently drop patches. If I do, please send me a rude email. If I get a patch, then either it will get merged, or the thing that patch does will be implemented by some other means, probably by some other person. Or the patch will... We was up to. And the originator is owed, and he will receive a clear explanation of why the patch was dropped. Simply letting other people's work dangle on in some uncertain limbo land is of no benefit to anyone, and we do need to handle every patch we receive in some dispositive manner. Now, most of this... A lot of the maintainers do have slippery fingers. I'll frequently see patches go past that might be to a sound driver or a SCSI driver or a net patch or something like that. And they do slip through. So one of the things I do is to act as sort of a wicket keeper. If I see a patch come past, I'll stuff it in my tree, just so it gets handled in some definite way. I'll regularly see patches go flying past which touch areas in which I just don't have any particular expertise. I don't want to see the patches get ignored just because that relevant maintainer happens to be asleep. And it's because, as I say, the maintainer probably had a good reason for performing that piece of development. So I have a number of tricks up my reader, but I just stuff it in my tree. So the maintainer says, oh shit, look, Andrew's merged that patch, I better take a look at it. That works quite well. My other trick is what I'll call the lame follow-up. When somebody sends a patch and I don't know what it does, I'll just ask some stupid question, don't care what it is, just to get a bit of discussion going, and eventually the maintainer handling of that patch. Now you can all break out your little violins. The maintainer's function is, it's full on, it's a fairly exhausting thing. The work comes in 24/7, people working around the world, around the clock. Although I've noticed in recent years that things do get quiet over weekends, on weekdays nowadays, which is a distinct change. Anyway, if you take a bit of time off, the work just banks up. Your inbox is always there. And when you come back to it, you've still got all that work to do. If you decide to take it easy for a month or two and kick your feet, kick it back for a while, I've found the overall quality of the kernel will dip. That means if you want a good kernel, you end up working damn hard. I guess at some point in time I'll burn out, or I'll feel I'm just not doing the job well enough, and I'll look to hand it over to some younger fella. And then I'll personally go back to a programming role, get reskilled and de-scatterbrained. One thing I hope to do over the next year is to settle our development processes down a bit, over to other people to look after, basically to distribute the load a bit and make it all a bit fault-tolerant. Things are still pretty hectic at present. We're still changing processes and becoming more professional. But any of those jobs I do hand off, the lucky bunny who gets it, will need to understand that it's not a part-time job. In a few hours, otherwise you just introduce log jams and uncertainty, and people forget what they're working on. You really do need to turn stuff around quickly. Now, move on to the new development model. John Corbett gave a talk on this yesterday in considerably more detail than I'll enter into, and it was a very good talk. What happened in the 2.4 series? If you go back to 2.4.16, 2.4.20, that time frame. The 2.4 series was very stable. We're being very cautious about its maintenance. And most of the development work was being done in the 2.5 series. And what we observed was a lot of the vendors core and then shipping it to their customers. At one point in time where SUSE, I think, had 1,500 patches in their tree against the mainline kernel. Not all of those are backported from 2.5. A lot of them were SUSE's own fixes and drivers and things from partners, etc. But it was a hell of a patch load. It was a lot of cost for them to carry all of those patches. And, of course, it globally introduces a risk of feature divergence between them. Was that some of the features we put into 2.5 were simply too large and too intrusive for the vendors to backport. Things such as the block I.O. scalability work, the VM scalability work, and many, many other things. They just sat in 2.5. So we ended up in a situation with the stable and the unstable kernel streams. So what's happening now? We don't make radical changes in the kernel world. We don't sit down and think, let's change our processes this way. We always make small incremental changes. Try things, if it doesn't work, back it out. It's a very cautious and conservative approach to managing our own processes. A couple of weeks, once every 4 weeks or so. And we're very good about it. People would put all their big features in very early in the cycle, and then we go through a stabilization phase, and then we'd do a release and start pouring patches in again. In fact, generated a little graph of this a little while ago. It's quite nice. It's basically cup-shaped with the rate at which we're introducing patches. But the kernel no longer uses the dictator model, wherein absolutely everything would go through Linus and he'd read every line of code. We've done a lot more decentralization and delegation nowadays. We have 30, 40, 50 subsystem trees, each of which have an identified maintainer for. Each of those subsystem trees has an individual maintainer, and generally speaking, if he sends stuff into Linus or myself that goes in the tree, we won't look at it. So it's not like, say, the BSD, where various individuals have commit rights to actually make commits into the top of the tree, but effectively it is like that, because, you know, if the USB or IA64 go for it time, etc. All of those subsystem trees, all 30 to 40 of them, are aggregated into my kernel, which for historical reasons is called the MM kernel, for purposes of testing and reviewing. In my kernel, I'll also accumulate random patches from individual contributors. I'll also keep a few subsystem trees in the prime copy of the patch will remain in my tree before it goes onto Linus. The subsystem maintainers who own a BitKeeper tree will decide when they believe that their tree is ready to go into Linus, and generally that should be after it's had a sufficient amount of testing in the NM kernel, patches to Linus. I just put a copy of my tree for testing, and it's a subsystem maintainer who'll send the tree into Linus. Pretty much all the other patches, which aren't a BitKeeper tree, do go into me, and then I sit on for a while, and then they go into Linus. The MN kernel isn't magic, and I've got a sneaking suspicion that some people think it is, judging by the quality of the stuff they send me. Problems do leak through, but an MM, so the more exposure, the more testing it's had. And the subsystem maintainers do like to see their trees have got a decent amount of testing in MM to give them that degree of confidence before they'll send it on to Linus. So one important effect of the MM tree is that it keeps the quality of Linus's kernel reasonably high, so we avoid the problem where the kernel is released once we've done 2.6.10. The subsystem maintainers will then merge their trees into mainline, and then quickly we'll go into stabilization phase, while all new feature work accumulates in the subsystem trees and hence in MM for the next release. So where do we switch development models? Production kernel. I think the kernel stability is continuing to increase. Features are going in at a high rate and with relatively low delays. And there's just no obvious reason for us to change back to a 2.4 style process. So we kept doing what we're doing. Now, please don't think that I'm saying that what we're doing in 2.4 was per se a wrong thing. The kernel technology, if we'd tried this trick in 2.4 series, we would have come unstuck and just broken the thing horribly all the time. We do need to recognize now that there are many more developers writing code, and they're writing it faster and better than they used to. The rate and volume of change pressure is much higher now than it was a few years ago. We have more developers and better ones, companies who employ them. These are people who are working to improve the kernel and get features out for their end users. And these developers very reasonably expect that their work will be delivered into the hands of their consumers within the minimum possible time. Another major customer for Linus and I is the distributors, the people who expect to be able to deliver the latest bunch of kernel goodies to their customers. Quick pity and poll, how many people are running a kernel.org kernel here, please?
Oh, shit.
Okay. That's a lot. It's about half of them. What the new development model does, it forces all these three customer groups to use the same tree. In the 2.4 model, we offered two separate. So we ended up in a situation where neither of the kernels sitting on kernel.org were suitable for our most important customers, the distros. The 2.4 kernel was a bit too old and crufty, and the 2.5 kernel was too unstable, so they ended up taking a mix of both. So we, the kernel development team, were basically working in a manner which is inappropriate for our development trees, 2.4 stream, 2.5 stream. Was it permits developers to perform very deep, very broad, and very buggy changes to the public tree without disrupting the whole world, without breaking the kernel. A developer who's rewriting some core part of the kernel in a fundamental way can do that without being afraid that any slip-up which they make will destroy the kernel for all the users. It may destroy it for all the developers, but all the users listen to use, for a number of reasons. One is the kernel code base is better than it used to be. We've done most of that fundamental rework. Right now, I'm not aware of any person who is holding any plans for any rewrite of anything which would be so risky and intrusive before. Related to that, we've fine-tuned our development process to the stage where we can and do make these big changes. And generally, they're things which the distributors wanted to see. To a large extent, the MM kernel is the development tree, and Linus's tree is the stable tree. Well, I figure a two-month release cycle at present. Generally, stuff in MM is about 2 months ahead of what's in Linus's tree, and compare that to the old 3 years. So it's one order of magnitude, anyway. Uh, Could it deploy development kernels on a wide variety of hardware and use it on real-world workloads? They'll quickly pick up on any problems and regressions and that sort of thing, and they'll hopefully report the problem and work with the relevant developer in getting it fixed up. I was looking at the kernel.org server logs a while ago, and I figured that each MM kernel, because they're only for kernel.org itself and not all the national mirrors. It's a lot of testers. And again, I cannot overemphasize how important those people are to the entire kernel effort. We developers and the big tech companies, we're testing the kernel day by day until we're blue in the face. But the number of bugs which we pick up is only a small fraction of that number which come in. Considered to be going well with the new development model. We're able to get most of the work which people want merged into the tree in reasonable time frames without breaking too much stuff. We're sustaining a high rate of change. Last time I looked, we're putting about 10 megabytes of patches a month into the tree. These consist of fixes and features and speed-ups and maintainability changes, scale hardware, although they don't pick up many problems. And I think the kernel quality continues to increase. We're fixing a ton of bugs, and I don't believe we're adding new ones at the same rate. Also, the various development teams who contribute to the kernel and who use the kernel, they appear to be reasonably happy about their ability to get the feedback. Conceptually different things. One is we could view it as a technology. It's an ever-moving, ever-growing, ever-improving code base, which is a tool, it's just a component, a technology component, which others can take and integrate into an end product. Usually that's a Linux distribution, although it might be a washing machine or a set-top box or whatever. The old development model in the 2.4 series, the only thing which the kernel team really produced was a product. And if you look at the number of patches the vendors are providing, we didn't do it very well. The 2.4 kernel is well stabilized, cautiously developed, and suitable for direct deployment in production. But the 2.5 kernel wasn't suitable for uses into maintaining and stabilizing a product. But that's not our job. It's not what we do. And to some extent, it duplicates the work which the various people who do provide products were doing. Now, if you go back a couple of years, what the kernel team had to offer was an overly cautiously maintained stable kernel, which is missing important features, and the significant, the massive backporting and patching exercise which the vendors were forced to do was a significant cost for their people who really are productizing Linux, and it introduces that risk of feature drift between the various distributions, which I mentioned before. I prefer that the distributor kernels be as close as possible to the kernel.org kernel. Every release we put out seems to have a handful of new niggling little problems, which just we break person A's USB camera, or we break person B's frame buffer driver, or person C suspend a disk. If anybody's suspend a disk works, we broke it. trust me, they really are little fine people. I think it's a relatively tiny group who do expect and believe that the kernel.org kernel should be as stable as we can possibly make it. And they're looking to kernel.org for product, not for a technology. Now, if you look at this from a political point of view, what we have is it's classic competition for a fixed resource between interest groups on the one. And the resource for which these two interest groups are competing is the kernel. The kernel development team themselves, the sweat of our collective brow. And when you get interest groups competing for resources, you do get some conflict. I'd say that in the past, the product group's interests were better catered for. Half the people here use kernel.org kernels. But please, you do need to understand that there is the other group, and they have interests as well. One of our roles in the kernel world is to find a balance between these competing interests. So I'm sitting in the middle of all this scratching my head. Most of the kernel, but our most valuable testing resources come from the product group. They're the well-intentioned volunteers who will deploy the latest kernel on their home machines or on their company's servers, kick the tires and see what breaks and provide us with their valuable testing feedback. And the whole effort would come to a halt if we didn't have those people. If we regularly break the kernel to too great an extent, test, as I've said about 7 times so far, is very important. And this is why I think it's very damaging if people go out there and exaggerate the extent of problems in the 2.6 kernel. If people get on some message board or a mailing list and unfairly say, oh no, the whole thing's busted, then that can dissuade other people and we'll lose some of our testing resources. What's especially urgent, we do want the major releases, the 2.6.8, 2.6.9, 2.6.10, the 3-digit releases, to be as stable and as product-like as possible, of course. The main tool we have at our disposal for doing that is to just turn off the tap. We'll typically spend a month with the kernel in a state of semi-code freeze. We're sitting there by our computers waiting for reports of that stabilization period as the whole kernel team is digging in during that month and helping to produce a top quality release. I think what happens is a lot of the guys go to sleep and start working on the fun feature stuff for the next release. And here's our big problem. We've gone through this lovely stabilization period, we've released this shiny new kernel, and of course lots of people find lots of new. A couple of months ago I proposed that we could make our even numbered releases, say 2.6.2, 4.6.8, make them bug fix only releases. So when 2.6.13 comes out, it'll be a regular release, just as we have at present. But 2.6.14 would contain no new features, it would be stability only. That would be, hopefully, say, this is the 2.6.13 kernel. Now, that discussion we had about making the even-numbered releases be bug-fix-only releases quickly got sidetracked. And we now have a new scheme of having what we call the stable series. We released 2.6.11, and now a group of developers are the only reason the stable series exists is to address the concerns of the product interest group. If you go back to the model of two interest groups competing for resources, we've made a modification, we've moved some of our resources into addressing the interests of the product group, away from the technology group. Right now, and we've only done it in 2.6.11, right now I don't think it's a little too high. And sometimes some of the things that we need to fix are just too intrusive or too dependent on other work that we've done to feasibly backport into the stable series. My expectation is if we want to make the stable series a success, we'll end up pushing even more resources in that direction. And I have another problem with the stable series, communicating to the other developers. Until we all dig in and find and fix them bugs, well, the kernel just isn't going to go anywhere. Everything's stopped. We won't start again.
Why don't you just drop over to your decimal points off the end?
Later. People get so worked up about numbers. Still, if the stable series, the 2.6.11.x 4-digit branch, if that's useful to some people, then good. It'll get us more testers, but I think it wholly fails to address the main problem. And that problem is the recurring breakage that we're having in the mainline releases, 2.6.10, 2.6.11, etc. 4-digit stable series. Okay, maybe that's how things will eventually work out. And cautious people, they see 2.6.18 comes out, well, they're just going to twiddle their thumbs until we hit 2.6.18.4, and then they'll use it. That's good for the product people, the end users, the people who want a kernel.org kernel. But I do believe at this stage that the kernel that efficiently reviewed code, code which doesn't even compile, or which does compile on one architecture, or doesn't compile on the other, or does compile with your config but not with anybody else's. And it's wasteful of resources to try and fix these things up once they've started to flow down into subsystem trees, into bashmm and into Linus's tree. I need to find some process by which I can push back on all these individual developments. The 2.7 series, push all the new development into there, and from then on we'll backport maybe a few things into 2.6 stream as they stabilize in 2.7. I continue to resist that for a number of reasons. First is it seems quite an arbitrary thing to do. At what point would we perform the branch of 2.7? Would it be a 2.6.13 ship to their customers? As I stated before, if the productization groups such as distro vendors were to base their products off the now orphan 2.6 series, then they'd quickly get back into the old problem of having to backport tons of patches from the 2.7 series. Only this time around, the problem would be much worse than it was in the 2.4 time frame, because it apparent in the weeks after a major release. So a few of the things which I intend to do about these regressions which continue to appear in the 2.6 releases. First up, it would be good if we could find some way of increasing the quality and the quantity of the testing and the bug reports which we get from our long-suffering testing community. Now there's a way to persuade more people to voluntarily get in and help us out. We can communicate our wishes better to the various websites which track kernel development and Linux-related news. We can revisit my harebrained scheme of making the 2.6.even numbers be bug fixed only. We can also set in place a system where testers actually get, and it's a ton of work for them to enter into a multi-day email dialogue with a kernel developer, testing stuff, setting up serial consoles, trying patches, gathering additional debug info, etc. Right now, the testers who take on these tons of work, people who did most of the work, they get no formal thanks or credit or money or loose women or anything for a valuable service. So I'll take that up at Kernel Summit and we'll probably come up with a more formalized process. Just so if somebody's helped us fix a particular nasty bug, he'll have his name up there in the formal kernel release announcement. It'll be in the formal kernel revision control tree, etc. Beg your pardon? There are reasons why we all appear to be so slack. I think there are three areas where we can gain from this. If we're trying to be more serious about our bug tracking, it will increase the care with which those pestiferous individual developers will take in their development test processes. They'll be more careful, because hopefully the developers will be motivated by the increased attention which they're seeing paid to regressions, and they will put a success rate in resolving the bug reports to which we do respond. As each bug is tracked, we can bring it to some sort of definitive resolution and not just leave it dangling. We do have a kernel bugzilla, of course, and I have a long history of saying rude things about it. Because bugzilla, it performs two main functions. System. It's the channel, it's the medium by which the reporter of the bug and the relevant developer will communicate to bring the bug to some sort of resolution. And this process in which two individuals communicate via a web interface is very, very bad for kernel development. Because in the greater more free to pitch in and add additional insights and suggestions, you wouldn't think a process like that scales, but it has thus far. And it's a very fruitful way of solving problems. Another advantage of the many-to-many model is that all the observers, they'll learn a bit more about that part of the kernel which is under discussion. And they get to observe the problem resolution, get a copy of every new entry which goes into Bugzilla. And right now, I'm very naughty. What I'll generally do is if I think it's a real bug, I'll bounce it straight up to Manolis and cut Bugzilla out of the loop. Simply because I am so against that point-to-point problem resolution process. So for us, Bugzilla is fine for tracking bugs, but as it's currently set up, it's not very good for resolving bugs. Those that you come in via Bugzilla. And as we're closer to a 2.6.12 release, I'm just going to chase all these down via email, spamming people, prior to letting Linus release 2.6.12. Of course, this process is very inefficient and probably lossy as well. See scatterbrained above. Now, software bug at all. You just end up sitting there staring at the bug report. If the reporter tells you it wasn't repeatable and you don't have a theory as to what caused the crash, all you can really do is shrug your shoulders and move on. And assume that if there really is a bug in there, at some later stage someone else will come across it and they'll actually have a way of reproducing it and they'll have the preparedness to work with. For kernel bugs, there's a lot of noise which needs to be filtered out. And a lot of bugs will, if we would attempt to track them all, many of them will just hang around in an unresolved, cannot reproduce state. We tend to ignore all these once-off reports, and it's only when a bug becomes repeatable or it has multiple people reporting it that it becomes obvious there really is a bug in there and we have a chance of resolving it. Or even the English language skills for us to be able to successfully resolve the problem with that individual via remote control. And when this happens, again, we've got no choice but to shrug our shoulders, move on, and hope that somebody else later on who does have the time, inclination and skills will hit the same bug and then we'll nail it at that point. So I believe we do want Bugzilla's bug appropriate bug number determined by parsing the email subject. So what will happen is when somebody enters a new Bugzilla entry, I'll perform the initial screening. I think it's a real bug, we've got a chance of resolving it. I'll probably just bounce that bug up to a mailing list. And but then Bugzilla will be kept on the CC and it will keep track of the else can do that. Now, I expect over time we will train more bug reporters to initiate at least the first contact via Bugzilla rather than via email. So if all this goes well, and when a kernel release is getting close, we'll start to look at the various open bugs, and I can start harassing developers and getting these bugs resolved in some manner, and we'll have better visibility. I'll develop the processes myself initially, and once we've found something which is workable, and if it's judged to be useful, then I'll be looking to find someone else to take over the function of tracking the bugs and chasing down the stragglers prior to us performing a release. Although I'd probably retain that function of the initial screening, deciding which bugs are worth pursuing and which are just so ephemeral that we should give them a pass. And all that's what I do. I had several reasons. One is the general free software philosophical thing, that one shouldn't use such software. Other reason I wasn't happy with the choice to use BitKeeper was my expectation that at some stage the interests of the kernel and the interests of BitMover would diverge, such a point that something would snap and the kernel would go. And I mean we should adopt a team of people who have a tool, not a tool. We shouldn't adopt it based on the technology, because if you've got a good team of people to work with, well, you can evolve the product over time. But if you pick a good tool and its developers are insane, well, it's all going to come to tears. There's something about SCM. The kernel team would have conferred to that SCM team and their product. What I meant by the year 2005, the free software world would have a significantly better SCM tools at our disposal than we now find ourselves with. It may have been a bumpy ride for the kernel team, but I think as a sort of strategic investment, I would have preferred had we gone that way. But I mean this himself frequently performs. Git does apparently use a vast amount of disk space at present. Several other people are hopping on board the project already. I haven't paid much attention. I'm basically keeping my head down until the dust settles and the shrapnel stops flying. I expect some of the kernel subsystem teams will continue to use BitKeeper. Now, for many people working on free software projects, I don't think BitKeeper or any source code management system is the right tool to use anyway. Because an SCM creates a flat tree, if you like, the flat tree with a changelog going back through history. But if your day-to-day work involves developing patches against Linus's tree or some other person's tree, several years to maintain typically between 500 and 1,000 patches against Linus's tree. A number of other teams and individuals are using my scripts at present. I wouldn't recommend that anyone else use them, because my scripts are fairly crappy, and they're backed up by a very small development team, namely. So if you think you need an SCM for your free software project work, you might be wrong. Maybe you should be using Quill. If your work normally involves generating or receiving patches, which are against an externally maintained tree, that's quite probable that you do need to use Quill. Finally, on a daily basis. And it's also fairly common for GPL out of tree drivers to not work, like get some PCM CIA drivers from SourceForge and they don't compile or work correctly in the latest kernel. I'd very much prefer that they not compile rather than not work. If they don't compile, then the breakage is obvious. But if the thing compiles and doesn't run, framed by a need to preserve back compatibility, generally we'll just break the back compatibility. We like to keep the kernel evolving. We have a long-term view of all these short-term steps. So we refuse to allow these back compatibility issues to slow us down or to mucky up the kernel's internal interfaces. Now, binary interface stability, in no way would we want to lock ourselves into any sort of binary compatibility. So our standard comeback when somebody comes in and complains to us that, oh, you've broken the APIs again, is to tell them to get their own act together. get your code cleaned up, get it reviewed, get it submitted, get it merged, get into the tree, and then you don't have a problem anymore because we'll look after it, internal API back compatibility. That being said, people do like to use their ATI drivers and their NVIDIA drivers and VMware, etc., for very good reasons. And I don't like to screw those people over, believe it or not, unless we have a good need to do so. Simple reason that it irritates people, and I don't like irritating people, and it will reduce our testing base, which is fair enough. But I'm not completely dogmatic about these issues myself. I mean, sometimes it's very, very obvious that the bug which is being reported, it was just unrelated to that binary module anyway. And I'm much more interested in getting these bugs fixed up than I am in berating individuals for using naughty drivers. So they can then, within their external driver, put an ifdef in there and talk to the appropriate API. So just conditional compilation to help these external modules get through life. Some people object to that. I don't. If you own a GPL external module and you want some clamping down on this and rejecting some changes which seem rather gratuitous unless they do have a good reason behind them. One other thing we did recently, we introduced a feature removal schedule process wherein we'll nominate, rather than just ripping a feature out, we'll nominate a date at which that particular feature will be removed or will be altered. Typical time frame is a year. We'll see less of these incompatibilities in the future. And that brings me to the end of my prepared materials. And as I say, I really do value feedback which I get from people. Often helps me correct the course. And I can make changes in the kernel processes. It's a big, heavy ship. If you lean on the rudder hard enough, it does change direction. There's always somebody out there using it.